Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Stepmother, Redeeming a Disdained Vocation by Dorothy C. Bass, narrated by Kim Nemi. 1. Out of the Shadows. I am sitting in an Adirondack chair made of spruce from the forest that presses in on this alpine village from every side. Mark and I have come from Chicago to this, his favorite place in the world, for our honeymoon. Today he's out hiking, his fly rod in hand. He'll be back soon, almost certainly with a few rainbow trout for tomorrow's breakfast. On my lap is Mark's only child, and on her lap is the book that has become our favorite in the 4 days since we arrived. Kristen is almost 5 years old. In this moment, I can think of nothing I'd rather do than read this book to this lively, imaginative child. She leans forward into The Tale of Molly Whuppie, glancing up at me in knowing amusement whenever the overconfident giant sets another of his nefarious schemes in motion. At last, by wit and courage, Molly defeats him for good. Satisfied, Kristen and I lie back onto the warm, fragrant wood. I tilt my head to rest my cheek against her braided yellow hair, and our breathing falls into a shared rhythm, each breath longer than the last. This lap full of child, this communion with a little one for whom I already feel overwhelming love, brings a joy I've been seeking for years. I am at peace, and I can feel in the looseness of her limbs that she is too. But we are not alone. A white-haired gentleman, whom I have so far failed to notice, has been listening in on the story from a few yards away. When he spots an opening, he catches Kristen's eye, smiles, and speaks to her in a grandfatherly way. "I see that you and your mommy are both wearing the same T-shirt," he says. Hearing mommy, Kristen bolts upright and turns to me with a look of confusion and distress. Her mommy is hundreds of miles away. What is this man talking about? Our breathing quickens and diverges, and my joy shatters into pieces. I do not want to speak to this man. I try to will him away. But Kristen has been addressed, and she has turned to me for help, so I must answer for us both. "I'm not her mother," I say. "I'm her stepmother." As soon as I utter this ugly word, everything changes. Now her look is one of alarm.
"You are not my stepmother," she cries.
I can tell that stories she has heard are flashing through her mind. Stepmothers are wicked. Stepmothers are mean to little girls and boys. I try to comfort her, but I cannot say, "Of course, honey, you're right. I'm not your stepmother." All I can do is whisper, "Shh, shh, everything is okay," while I gather her again into my lap. She is not persuaded. Sobbing, she hides her face in my shoulder while I pat her back. I desperately wish that Mark would return to show her his catch and turn this day in a new direction. It soon becomes obvious that the white-haired gentleman is also distressed. He never intended to upset this child, and he is deeply sorry to have made her cry. His eyes downcast, he mumbles an apology and walks away. His sorrowful demeanor, I suspect, reflects a deeper concern as well. He is sad that a child so young has had to endure the breakup of her original home. He does not say this, but this is what I think I glimpse in his face, perhaps because I have suddenly had that same thought. How sad for Kristen that her parents have divorced. Caught up in my own new love, I have papered over the loss suffered by this little girl. I've been kidding myself, I realize. I don't belong here, in this chair, with this book holding this child. Kristen should be not on my lap, but on the lap of her mother, the woman who gave her birth, the woman with whom she has previously traveled to this place. An aunt, teacher, or babysitter might be acceptable as a temporary substitute, I suppose, but not a stepmother, a woman whose very presence proves that Kristen's young life has already been marred by grief, a woman who is possibly a homewrecker, probably a witch, and surely an interloper, a woman in whose body the terrible truth that families are fragile takes on flesh. In the 30-some years since that summer day, I've experienced the joy, sorrow, and confusion of stepmothering countless times. Happily, joy has come most often, but I'm pretty sure joy could surface only alongside acknowledgement that confusion and sorrow have also been present. The confusion is fueled in part by long-standing cultural images of stepmothers, of course. But confusion has also arisen in my own heart as fantasies of maternal fulfillment implode, as strangers make assumptions about my marriage, and as I try to figure out where I fit in the life of someone I love and often care for in mother-like ways, but whose mother I am not. And sorrow? A peaceful summer afternoon can come all too easily to an abrupt and tearful end. Those of us who choose partners who are parents step into relationships with children and adults already impacted by loss, and, importantly, loss within the very part of life we now share with them. Someone has died. Someone has divorced. Those who will come to be among our closest kin have been plunged into grief before we ever show up. Their stories are many and diverse, and in more than a few cases, the end of whatever came before was a good thing. Divorce can bring liberation from terrible situations, and I remain grateful for myself and others that divorce is an option. Still, I can't shake the conviction that the world would be a better place if families didn't have wrenching schisms. In such a world, there would be no kids shuttling back and forth, no tense relationships between a first spouse and a second. But that is not the world in which we live. In some imagined world where neither persons nor marriages die, there are no stepmothers. In the real world, stepmothers are everywhere, with hundreds of thousands of new stepmothers added to the tally each year in the United States alone. This sole statistic offers a glimpse into how fluid families are today and how rapidly they are changing, where one-third of all American children under 18 are or have been part of a stepfamily, and 42% of all American adults have at least one close step-relative. Yet how we understand our hopes and duties as family members has not kept pace with reality. Each stepfamily has its own story. At the same time, the simple fact that there are so many stepfamilies demonstrates a shift in how Americans do family in the 21st century. We who long for love and connection even after loss, we who yearn for reliable companions for ourselves and our children in a time when so many things are unstable, we who strive to create a new family after the first one has fallen apart, we are developing a form of family life that is being woven into the fabric of our society. This form of family life provides a pattern of belonging for millions of individuals of every age. Questions about what this new form means and how it works confront us at every turn. But here we are. And it's along this path that we hope to find love, sustenance, and joy. As our families walk this path, we stepmothers occupy a position that is crucial. Crucial meaning immensely important. Some books claim to tell you how to smooth everyone's journey and assure a fabulous outcome, which I too hope for and often see. But I also see our situation as surprisingly complicated, for stepmothers are well positioned to do harm as well as good. A stepmother is a stranger who has gained entry into the domestic world of a child. She may or may not be interested in developing a good relationship with the child or even in supporting the pre-existing relationship between her partner and the child. She may compete with her stepchildren for their parents' time and resources or allow her own children to do so. The worries underlying negative stereotypes of stepmothers are sometimes well-founded. Just as a stepmother can hurt others, so too can she be hurt, by anything from outright rejection to feeling marginalized, as other, more privileged caregivers set the schedules that shape her time. Thus, stepmothers occupy a position that is crucial in another sense as well. Crucial, meaning shaped like a cross, a site of suffering. Indeed, life on this cross may require a death of some kind. Perhaps jealousy will need to die, or resentment, or self-doubt, or fantasies about how things are supposed to be. Such emotions, even if well-founded, can prevent us from recognizing the new life that is actually on offer in our stepfamilies. When those of us who become stepmothers make a commitment to a new partner, we bring with us hopes as high, needs as great, and love as strong as those that accompany anyone else's leap into life together. But the terrain onto which we leap is strewn with hazards that are both material and spiritual. Being a stepmother is hard work, and we are unlikely to come through our labors unchanged. Some of our work will be done in the neighborhood, the kitchen, or the car. But the bulk of our work, the most important part, will need to be done within our own hearts. Being a stepmother is a complicated and demanding calling. For many of us, it's the hardest thing we've ever done. For all of us, it's among the most important. How we respond matters to the people we love and to us. What might it mean to embrace this difficult calling wisely and well? The first step is to bring stepmothers out of the shadows. One famous stepmother, the widow of Snow White's father, revels in shadows. She lives in a castle by day, but when night falls, she descends into a dark cellar. Transformed from beauty to hag, she prepares poison, not nourishment, for the youngster she ought to be protecting. An image of this horrid woman, the villain in Walt Disney's first feature film, sticks in the popular mind, along with a bevy of others like her. As Kristen's mother, Becca, wrote to me in an email, stepmother has only one adjective that can precede it. Wicked. Well, maybe two. Wicked or evil. Becca is a stepmother, too. We were commiserating about this widely held image. Even those of us who lack access to the dark arts often find that we have been cast into shadows conjured by moral judgment. While Americans are becoming more open to a range of family forms, patterns that disrupt the lives of children continue to be suspect. Preferring family constancy is understandable. But looking with disdain on individuals who are trying to adapt to unfamiliar circumstances is not. The shadow of judgment was cast on me in the course of my relatively fortunate daily life, and other stepmothers say they've felt that shadow too. Disclosing that the child assumed to be mine is actually my stepchild leads onto complicated terrain, and not only with white-haired gentlemen. I remember the first time Mark and I took Kristen to the church we had recently joined. "Oh, I didn't know you have a child," a woman remarked, catapulting me right back into that Adirondack chair in the mountains. My reply, "She's my stepdaughter," caused the woman to mutter something vague and turn away as if she didn't know what to say next. For years, I avoided mentioning our situation to people we did not know well, both to keep things simple and to protect myself from looks that seemed to range from disappointment to hostility. All of us in our humanness have probably earned our share of the distrust stepmothers attract. We are no better than other people, other parents, other women, but taken as a group, we are not any worse. And dispelling the shadows of distrust, disappointment, and disdain requires a gentle and generous approach with others and ourselves. We'll need to come to terms with the thoughts and emotions that sometimes cause us to lose sleep or lash out. And we'll need to open our eyes to the light that sometimes breaks through the shadows, beaming love into our stepmotherly hearts. Invisibility is a shadow of a different kind. We are absent from pictures of the baby coming home from the hospital. We cannot host the birthday party or sign the school forms. We may not be welcome at the wedding. Yet we are tied to our stepchildren in an intimate bond that has us performing something like motherhood for sizable portions of each year. When we resent our stepchildren, it feels like all eyes are upon us. When we love them like crazy, we often have to do our loving from the sidelines. Stepmothers are often the least visible members of step families. Researchers have studied us far less than other step family members. That matters. But of far greater concern to me is that we aren't fully visible to ourselves. Most of us attend closely to the needs of others. We try to do well by the children and nurture our marriages. We strive to create warm homes and strengthen our new families. And then, seemingly out of the blue, something happens that makes us feel like outsiders, hanging on at the margins of the parent-child relationships that predated us. Invisibility doesn't feel good. We want, rightly, to be seen, acknowledged, valued. And feeling invisible isn't good for us either. If we think we're invisible, we can excuse ourselves from grappling honestly with our emotions and the damage we sometimes endure or impose. Even worse, feeling like we're invisible can prevent us from noticing and enjoying the love that may actually be flowing our way. And besides, we are not actually invisible. We are there, right in the middle of our wonderful, difficult, ever-changing families, visible to anyone who is willing to notice, loving and being loved, struggling and improvising, yearning for a home that's life-giving for all, including us, and sometimes finding just that. This book brings stepmothers out of the shadows, but I've discovered that writing about stepmothering is almost as complicated as being a stepmother. Women who make commitments to love and care for a partner's child do so in many different personal, cultural, and economic contexts, producing countless specific patterns of parental work and relationship. I honor all such women, whatever their social location, identity, or marital status. While I earnestly hope that this book will be helpful to listeners across a wide range of circumstances, however, it is unavoidably shaped by my own experience. I hope this book will encourage other stepmothers to share their own stories and insights. Another complication is that my own story is entangled with stories that belong first of all to others, in this book as in life. When sharing family stories, I have worked very hard to speak only from and for my own experience and never to presume that I know what others were thinking at one point or another. If I have failed to meet this standard at certain points or have offended in any other way, I apologize. A few years ago, I sent an email to my stepdaughter telling her I was writing an essay that included some scenes from her childhood. Did she have any objections? When I showed her a draft, she asked for just one revision. "Please use my name," she said. She wanted to be visible, just as she had struggled to feel visible in both of the households to which she belonged as a child. "Although I was a welcome member of both homes," she has written, "I was not a necessary part of either's design." While I didn't agree that she was unnecessary to either family, I honored her desire to be known by name. She has a beautiful and unusual name that belonged to her father's great-great-grandmother. Even so, I've decided not to use her real name in this book, and I've also changed the names of Kristen's husband and children. I'm not trying to cloak anyone's identity, which is easy enough to figure out these days. Instead, I'm trying to clarify, for myself, family members, and readers, that this story is mine. When most of us think about stepfamilies, our attention and concern rightly go first to the children. In this book, I'm working hard to spotlight a different corner, hoping that doing so will benefit not only stepmothers, but also the other members of their families. I sent a similar email to Kristen's mother, whom I also mentioned in that essay. She, too, was agreeable, except for one thing. Trying to achieve some verbal variety, I had referred to myself in one sentence as Kristen's other mother. I am not her other mother, Becca pointed out. Kristen only has one mother, and she is that mother. I am Kristen's stepmother. If I would make that change, she wrote, she could readily approve the rest of the essay. I didn't even need to ask for her permission if I wrote about our family in the future, she added. I trust you. I made the change, but continue to ask for her permission when I publish things that mention her, though I haven't asked her to check specific pages. This approach, share information but don't pry into or supervise the details, is similar in a way to how we've balanced our separate relationships with Kristen. In this book, I have changed the names of Becca and her husband, Kristen's stepfather. Mark, my husband, Kristen's father, Becca's ex, was also supportive of that initial essay and now of this book. Recently, I asked him if he thought our marriage would have lasted if Kristen and I had not gotten along. "Of course," he replied. I hope he's right, but after my research for this book, I'm also aware of how damaging to marriages step-family conflicts can be. Mark's answer was wonderful, and I'm grateful for it. What he was saying is that our marriage belongs first of all to the two of us, and he trusts that it's strong enough that it could have survived more step-family difficulty than we have encountered. I share that trust and attribute it more to God's grace than to our own strength. Still, I'm relieved and delighted that Kristen and I do get along. That happened partly because Mark was such a loving father to her and such a supportive husband to me. I thank all three for allowing me to share aspects of our family story, but the perspective here is mine alone. I write as a stepmother, in a voice that is too often silent or silenced in conversations about families today. 2. Origins. Here's a short familiar story. A couple with a child splits up. Two new families form, and the child, now a member of both families, travels back and forth between them. The story is so familiar that it may feel ordinary, easy, no big deal. But for me, the experiences the story relates are not at all humdrum and easy to digest. I've lived this story, together with my second husband, Mark, his first wife, Becca, and their only child, Kristen. After a divorce of my own, I joined the story as Mark's spouse. That's how I became a stepmother. Follow the story a little further, and Becca marries a man with two sons. She becomes a stepmother, too. My divorce and Mark's happened independently after each of our first marriages found its own pitiful path to disaster. But even though these divorces were distinct, as other breakups also were and are, it's hard not to see both as belonging to a single, massive cultural shift gaining momentum in the 10 years after each of us said our initial marriage vows. Ours was the generation born and raised during the years of high fertility that followed the Second World War. Trends that had taken hold earlier in the century, fewer and later marriages, a declining birth rate, reversed themselves, and married with children became the national ideal. As suburbs were built and consumer-oriented nuclear families seized the popular imagination, Dad and Mom and Dick and Jane households multiplied from coast to coast. From 1948 to 1958, 85% of all new housing built in the United States was in the suburbs. Many Americans were excluded by race, economics, or sexual orientation from adopting the male breadwinner/female homemaker ideal, and some were simply not attracted to this way of life. Even so, such families, including the families Mark and I grew up in, were touted as normative in the media, at church, in public life, and in workplaces, where women were less present than they'd been during the war. After a brief post-war spike, the divorce rate plummeted. A little later, ours was also the generation most heavily influenced by a set of powerful challenges to this American family ideal. Challenges that heated up during the 1960s and boiled over during the 1970s. Astute observers within those decades suspected that post-war American marriages and families were not nearly as sturdy as 1950s popular media implied. But just about everyone would later agree that certain events during the next decade put further pressure on supposedly normative patterns. Between 1965 and 1980, the rate of divorce more than doubled. A social psychologist who studies marriage, Eli Finkel, attributes this rapid shift primarily to changes in culture that burrowed deep into individual souls. Self-expression was hailed and widely adopted as an indispensable sign of the good life. Other historians noticed scientific and economic changes that supported these same developments. The availability of birth control pills beginning in 1960, for example, and the increasing access of women to higher education and work beyond the home. Many women could now imagine and handle life apart from marriage, the institution on which most women in history had depended for both physical sustenance and social belonging. Those in oppressive situations could now leave. As divorce became both more common and more accepted, laws changed as well. In 1969, California became the first state to allow no-fault divorce proceedings, which simplified couples' ability to terminate marriages. The divorce rate peaked during the early 1980s. If you plotted all the divorces of the last century on a graph, Mark's and mine would be riding the crest of a tidal wave. During these years, more marriages ended each year than began. This is when an immensely discouraging warning, "Your chance of divorce is 50-50, began to shape both public and personal conversations about marriage. I was one of the casualties of this trend, or, depending on how you look at it, one of the causes. I now can see that I participated in a major demographic shift. But believe me, at the time, I did not feel like a statistic. When your heart has been ripped out, it's not much comfort to know that your experience is statistically normal. That said, I can't deny I was glad I did not stand out as uniquely unsuccessful in my personal life. I shudder to imagine the shame my aunt had to endure after her divorce in Texas in the 1930s. Today, divorce has lost its outward stigma in many communities. But individual feelings of failure and shame can still be hard to overcome. Those who end primary relationships not bound by marriage can also encounter such feelings. These changes have led to the emergence of a new kind of stepfamily. Starting in the early 1970s, for the first time in history, more stepfamilies were formed after a divorce than after a death. In recent years, stepfamilies have become three times more likely to come into being after the bereavement of separation or divorce than after a partner's death. And not all of these new stepfamilies turn out to be permanent. The divorce rate is slightly higher in second marriages than in first. When a social earthquake shakes the architecture of a given family form, for example, the Dad and Mom and Dick and Jane family, historians and anthropologists are not surprised. Across centuries and cultures, human beings have constructed countless forms of intimate bonding for mutual protection and care, arranging their lives and labor to provide for the needs of children, the aged, and those in between. To those living inside these arrangements, a given culture's pattern can seem natural, seamlessly joining how things are with assumptions about how things are meant to be. Such patterns can seem permanent. From the perspective of history, however, they are not. Family structures can and do change. One form weakens, people adapt, and another form emerges. Today's stepfamilies can be seen as proof that one more shift within the ongoing historical process of family formation is taking place. The big picture is this. The high value placed on individual choice, in combination with a commitment to ongoing personal development, has merged with material factors – longer lifespans, changing career patterns, lack of structural support for child-rearing and family life – to make commitments less likely to last over the course of a lifetime. In this context, trying again after a marriage ends makes sense, with stepfamilies part of the evolution of family. American marriage itself is becoming deinstitutionalized, according to sociologist Andrew Cherlin, who cites studies showing that formerly shared norms defining people's behavior and roles are becoming more individual and flexible and less tied to traditional expectations. When Cherlin first identified this trend in a study of step families back in the late 1970s, he predicted a subsequent process of reinstitutionalization.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?